You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. And we're back live today on Friday, January 11th, after a week of not being here in the station on Friday.
Yeah.
I'm really glad to have Mom back with me.
Well, it's nice to be here. And I live in Mount Pleasant, of course, and you folks got quite a bit more snow than we did. We just had a dusting, but I was surprised when I looked down and it's snowing again.
I guess we got a brief taste of what spring might be like soon.
Spring's coming.
Spring's coming, but it may be a couple months before
it may be.
Gets here.
But Monica's brother, my oldest son, called me from Missouri last night, and they had horrible vertical winds and terrible things. Tornadoes, 60 tornadoes in the Springfield area on Monday, and oh my gosh. So we're pretty lucky right here.
Yeah. It seems like tornadoes usually miss us here.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. Suppose it's MUM, I suppose.
So, Mom, have you been reading anything the last couple of weeks?
Yes, I've been reading. I've been reading the book we're going to be talking about today, because it's a big book, and it's an interesting book. And it takes concentration to read it, but also it moves, in parts, it moves very quickly, because it's about French Revolution. Mm-hmm. Interesting topic.
So our guest today is James Tipton, author of Annette Vallon, A Novel of the French Revolution. Welcome to KRUU, James.
Hello, thank you.
And I understand that you have some connection with Fairfield, that you lived here at one time?
Yes, I taught in the early 90s at the university there, and really liked the community and the kind of literary nature of the community. There's a lot of people that read a lot there.
And where do you live now?
I live in Marin County, just north of San Francisco, and teach here.
Oh, that is a beautiful place.
Yes, it is. Redwood trees, right near the ocean also.
We were just talking about Northern California with a gentleman here in the station before we came into the studio, because that's where he was born, that's where I was born. Was up in Nevada City, and the one time that I've been back there since my family left when I was three, I did make a stop in Marin also, and absolutely fell in love with it and knew there was no way I could ever afford to live there.
Oh, well, you can find some humble places.
So, James, well, let's start with, why don't you tell us, give us kind of an overview of this novel?
Well, it's about a woman who's a literary footnote. If anyone has studied William Wordsworth in college, they'll come upon this little footnote sometimes. And I expanded that little reference into a whole character in a story. But it's basically about the French Revolution from the point of view of this young woman. I see it as a kind of hero's adventure, except for this time the hero was a woman, instead of the traditional hero's adventure being a man, like Odysseus or something. And the story, there's really two stories going on. One is her relationship with the young English poet William Wordsworth, who then becomes a very famous poet, but not when she knew him, when he was 21. And their relationship and how the war and revolution separates them. And the other part of the story is how she gets involved with resistance work against the Reign of Terror that's chopping people's heads off, and later on, even against Napoleon. So those are the two stories that go side by side throughout the novel.
You know, I was talking with Monica, that the French resistance was very important to us during the Second World War, because, of course, Germany occupied France, and we were trying to infiltrate into there, and the French resistance was extremely helpful and important. And she is like the resistance person. And she's very interesting. I want to say this. You certainly can write, it's written in the first person, you certainly can write from a woman's point of view. And I think that's very interesting.
how did you do that?
Well, it's part of the writer's job that he's got to think about other points of view.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it's I actually started writing it in third person, and it just didn't happen. This didn't work. So this has got to be her story. It's her untold story.
Right.
And so it's got to be in her voice. So there's this tradition of what's called the persona, where the writer adopts a voice, adopts a character, and speaks in that. It went way back to Chaucer and the Wife of Bath, or Daniel Defoe, after he takes on the voice of Robinson Crusoe, he takes on the voice of Moll Flanders, who was this kind of roguish woman of the 18th century. So I just did that tradition. When I'm teaching creative writing, I told my students, try to write sometimes like you're somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
That actually can help your writing and open you up. So I took on her voice, and once I kind of got into her voice, it wasn't hard to get back to it, you know, as I was continuing the novel. But I also think there's a lot of universals in perception and emotion for men and women. I also was drawing on that. Although it was tricky sometimes, you know, I had to keep reminding myself, okay, she has a dress, she's writing sight now, you know. Sometimes it was, I felt like Huck Finn at the end of his, the end of his narrative, when Huck says, if I'd have known what a trouble it was to make a book, I wouldn't have tackled it.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to do it again.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, I wanted to ask you, too, when you start a novel, do you make an outline? Do you know how it's going to end, or what is the process there?
Well, with this story, I knew something about where I was going to go because of the biographies of William Wordsworth
mm-hmm.
and the actual, you know, real story itself that it was based on. So keeping to that in my mind and keeping to the historical parameters, I just kind of took off. So, no, I didn't have an actual physical outline. I had some thought outlines in the back of my head.
I can see in some ways it would be easier to write a novel like this where the plot is basically laid out for you and you don't have to imagine, you know, you don't have to imagine that, make that part up. For me, as a writer, sometimes figuring out what the ending of a story is can be the hardest part. So,
well, I still kind of had to make that up because no one really knows, enough about their relationship. And then once I got involved in the revolution and resistance work, I had to make up a lot of stuff according to what I thought she did.
Well, that
and
was
about his time with her, because no one knows very much about their time together. They just know that he was in France for a year. So I had these parameters, and that kind of gave me that basis that you're talking about that made it easier for me then to just kind of fill in.
Okay, he was kind of naive about the revolution, wasn't he?
I mean, I think you could say that. because he went off with all these ideals, but so many people had these huge ideals about the revolution, and he was no exception, also coming from England, thinking that this was going to be the thing that was going to transform the world
mm-hmm.
and make the whole world better in a place of equality and brotherhood.
Well, he says at one point, you have a quote in the book, all the precious ideals of the revolution have turned to tyranny.
Yes, he got disillusioned.
Mm-hmm.
when the Reign of Terror started, it was people couldn't believe it because the revolution did start out with all these high ideals. And then it was really taken over, hijacked, one could say, by this fanatical minority with Robespierre and
mm-hmm.
his group called the Jacobins. So it's possible that it could have stayed with those ideals, but it didn't make it, and Wordsworth became highly disillusioned with everything. And in my story, he has to flee
mm-hmm.
his life because of the Reign of Terror. And if you were a foreigner, most likely you'd end up on the guillotine.
Well, you were just suspected to be a spy no matter what.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So what exactly was the Reign of Terror?
the Reign of Terror was based on the politics of fear.
Sounds familiar.
That's pretty well it was. The National Assembly proclaimed that all legislators place terror on the order of the day. That's their quote. And to me, there's two main things going on. One is that you have politicians manipulating fears of the legislators and of their people to get rid of their own opponents within the government and have then a monopoly of power. For instance, Robespierre and his extremist group called the Jacobins used the Reign of Terror to invalidate, imprison, and kill members of the more moderate group called the Girondins, whom Wordsworth was associated with,
mm-hmm.
Accusing them of being counter-revolutionary, sympathetic to the royals, etc. All you had to do was accuse someone of being not patriotic or a threat to national security, and boom, you could arrest them and get them killed. And then fear, of course, does horrible things to people. And the fear of the counter-revolution became a paranoia. And anyone who said or did anything slightly contrary to government policies was arrested, given a mock trial at a tribunal, and then often executed.
Now, this was after the king and nobles had been executed because they were of the royal, because they were, you know, aristocracy, right?
The execution of the king kind of started the whole thing, kind of gave them the green light. Oh, look what we can do.
Yeah.
You know? And then you also had people that wanted to make points of the government by denouncing others. And you're talking about World War II, of course. This happened in World War II.
Yeah.
The Reign of Terror was carried out by this committee called the Committee of Safety, which is kind of like the Gestapo or the Spanish Inquisition. It's a totally ironic name, where you could denounce anyone. And this Committee of Safety was in each town. It originally was called the Committee of Surveillance, a more honest name. But the Girondins, the more moderates, said, oh, we can't have that, Committee of Surveillance. That goes against our policies of the Republic. So they disbanded it, and then Robespierre and his group came back several months later with the same committee, just with a different name. Now it's called the Committee of Safety. And it's just like Orwell's doublespeak, you know, things going on in politics in all sorts of different generations where you make something sound completely different than what it is, you know. And they could arrest anybody. For instance, let me give you a few examples that are actually in the book. There's older aristocrats that were arrested for singing hymns on the way carrying a deceased friend to a cemetery, because although the new laws of the revolution gave you freedom of belief, they didn't give you freedom of expression of that belief. They were arrested for singing hymns. A woman was arrested for not wearing or displaying the tricolor cockade, the red, white, and blue cockade you're supposed to have.
Mm-hmm.
A man arrested for hiding his son when the draft representatives came to his village. Priests arrested quite often if they would not take the vows that said that their first allegiance was to the Republic rather than to their religion. And here's the most absurd one. A mother and daughter arrested because they were overheard saying that the revolutionary government was boorish for shutting down their favorite fashion magazine.
Oh.
That's the kind of thing people could be arrested for.
Wow.
That's how far it got out of hand.
That's the Reign of Terror, that you didn't know, and you really couldn't trust anybody because you might say something, and then somebody else could say, oh, she said this, and arrest her.
Kind of stopped conversation, didn't it?
Yeah. You know, Dickens has some of this in Tale of Two Cities.
Right.
Oh, yes, of course.
But you might want to see the movie with, I believe it's Ronald Coleman, and they have him on trial, and they have these kind of absurdity and these the fanaticism that was going on there.
Yeah, he's the one, and his last line was, it's a far, far better thing I do than I've ever done, and it's a far, far better place.
His self-sacrifice.
Yeah, because he looked like the guy that they spirited out of the country, so, and they thought they were hanging him.
Because it was virtually impossible to save anybody from the guillotine, so they switched.
And then there was one chapter in your book about the massacre in the prisons, which I thought was pretty awful, and that must have really disillusioned a lot of people.
Yes, the September massacres, they're called, in September of 1792, when Wordsworth was still there. This was actually before what was officially called the Reign of Terror. This was something that was totally generated by the fear and the paranoia of counter-revolution that got just completely out of hand. You had shopkeepers in there doing these tribunals and just executing people on their own with hatchets and anything they had.
Yeah. Well, Monica and I were talking about our American Revolution, and of course, it's you said that the French Revolution basically started because of the lack of bread, but there were so many peasants, and we didn't have that peasant class in the United States.
Right.
And so it was a totally different thing.
Yes. I had Thomas Jefferson in the very first chapter saying, well, I hope you never have a revolution in this country, meaning France, mm-hmm. because revolution in my country was very different. It was against a foreign power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, also.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this was a revolution of class, and it had all that class hatred behind it.
Well, you're listening to KRUULP, Writer's Voices, with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is James Tipton, author of Annette Vallon, A Novel of the French Revolution. James, what is it about this character, this woman, that attracted you to want to invest, I believe it's 15 years of your life, into writing her story?
It was actually about 3.5 years, and then I put it away for a long time and came back to it many years later for another year and a half. But, yeah, overall it's about 15. Well, it's an untold story. I'll give you a little story. I'm 18. I'm a freshman in college, and I'm in a class on the Romantic poets, and the professor's talking about William Wordsworth. And I think his poetry maybe is a little bit stuffy to me at that age and a little bit ponderous with some of his religious references, phrases like Abraham's bosom that I didn't know. And then the professor stops, kind of leans forward on his podium and says to the class, well, you know, Wordsworth wasn't always like this. In the French Revolution, he was actually there and he was hot in it. And he had a French lover who bore him an illegitimate child. And I'm sitting in the back of the room thinking, wow, this sounds more interesting than the poem I'm actually reading, you know? And many years later, I'm at MIU in Fairfield teaching the same class on the Romantic poets, and call upon the same footnote that the professor had referenced that no one in the class had read, because college students don't read footnotes too well. And here's the same footnote that makes reference to his illegitimate child. I go, well, it's been many years now, and no one's written this story. I think I'm just going to go and see what I can do. It just attracted me. There was this untold story that one could use one's imagination with, combined with history and combined with poetry, because I love poetry, and Wordsworth was a young man obsessed with poetry at that time. Then I needed to do some research, of course, so when I first was checking out things on Annette Vallon, I found out three interesting things. One was that she and Wordsworth kept a correspondence of letters going for a long time. It wasn't just a little, you know, flash-in-the-pan relationship. But not that Wordsworth could have something like that. He's such a serious and sincere fellow. But they kept letters going when he came back to England, and then those letters were disturbed, of course, by the war. Then they met again. As soon as there was a peace between the two countries, he was right across the channel in Calais, France. And they met again later. This is something that even is not in my book, 1820. So they had a friendship that lasted their whole lives.
Mm.
I also then found out that she was involved very deeply with resistance against the Reign of Terror, and that inspired me to write about those kind of stories, because I like adventure stories. And then I found out that the critics pretty much universally treat her a little frigidly. And I thought that wasn't right. It was as if to give her due would somehow take away from the great poet Wordsworth. So I thought I wanted to reverse that tendency in my novel. So it was those things that pulled me into it. And also in the early part of the research, reading a couple of her letters that somehow survived. The only reason we know about her is that a couple of these letters were found. These letters would just break your heart. I know it, and they touched me so much. I thought, oh, okay, I want to take on her voice. These letters that were saying to him that, actually, can I give a little reference to one?
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
I'm just translating from a French, from the French I have here on my desk. Come, my friend, my husband, receive the tender kisses of your wife of your daughter. She is so pretty, this poor little one. She's so pretty that the tenderness that I feel for her would drive me crazy if I didn't have her continually in my arms. She resembles you more and more every day. I believe when I'm holding her, it is you whom I have in my arms. When are you returning? She says, I know it's dangerous to return, but, you know, I hope you can. And it ends with a quote that I have in the beginning of my book. I'm going to read this in French because it sounds much better in French. and forgive my accent. Aime toujours ta petite fille et ton Annette. Always love your little daughter and your Annette. Qui t'embrasse mille fois sur la bouche, sur les yeux, who embraces you, who kisses you a million times on the mouth, on the eyes. I will write you again on Sunday. And then she says, adieu, je t'aime pour la vie. Goodbye, I love you for life. And mm-hmm. I read that, and oh, God. And I realized that Wordsworth never got this letter.
It's amazing that that they survived, but it's amazing that that they wrote, could write and send letters during that time. Because
well,
it was so...
it was just a short period of time. And they did get some, but this was impounded just before the war started between the countries.
Mm.
And it never got to him because I think it had address to England on it, you know, on
mm-hmm.
the tear. And then once the war started, they couldn't do letters at all. Every once in a while, something would get through.
When he came back, and he was, of course, involved with a woman in England, came back with his sister, I was very interested that that Annette never challenged him about Mary, never... admonished him about that, realized that he was, you know, going to go back to England and be with her and that she was going to lose him and so forth. I mean, that she was quite a woman.
Well, I think she had to be very strong inside. She had to accept the reality that here's a man who had now his own life in the north of England, and the reality of it was he couldn't come to France because they knew the war was going to resume and they were just having this brief peace.
Mm-hmm.
And she was also... attached to her work, you know, her resistance work in France, and so she wasn't really going to go there. And they had both kind of developed their own lives in those 9 years. But I think it was very hard for her also, because for 9 years she had this idea they were somehow going to get together.
Right, mm. Right.
And she had to be strong inside and let that go and not... accuse him, understanding that, well, he did have to develop his life. And then he makes reference to in that, it was a very hard chapter to write, a couple chapters in there, because I didn't want him to come off as a bad guy. It was very easy to have him to be the callous male that throws her away, and
right.
Feminists have kind of seen him like that. But I wanted them both to come off as sympathetic, or at least for a reader to understand where he was coming from. So that was hard, and he made references to some poems that he wrote about a character that no one knows who this character is called Lucy. Critics have said different things, and biographers have said different things, so I thought, well, why not have Lucy also maybe refer to Annette? Lucy is this strange character who dies in his poems, and my feeling was, you know, a writer also has to write from his life and has to draw from his subconscious, and maybe he was writing about her, about when Lucy was dying, because he had to, in effect, kill Annette inside himself to move on. So psychologically,
right.
That made sense to me. He says the symbols may shift, and sometimes Lucy may be something else, but in some of the poems, that's what he's dealing with. So he's also explaining that to her, and I think she's understanding, so they can both move on in their lives.
Well, you had, speaking of death, there's a passage there where about the death, the lesson of the fog, about her father's death. You can't see the person anymore, but it's like the fog covering the river, but you know the river's still there.
Yes.
I thought that was really great.
Well, you know, writers can cheat a little bit. I cheated on that reference because when my son was very young, when I was writing that, he and I were talking about the fog. We had just moved back to Berkeley, and of course there was fog in the San Francisco Bay, and I was saying, look, you can't see the bay, but you know it's there. the fog's coming. We're having this conversation, and then I was writing that afternoon and used that. It was the Loire River and the fog as a metaphor for death.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't see the person after they're dead. That doesn't mean they're not still there in some way. And then my son comes into my room when I'm writing. He says, "Dad, is death when you can't see the person anymore?" I went,
oh,
whoa.
Wow.
Yeah. Isn't that great? I mean,
I just typed that right in.
You betcha.
Right in. And I go, you know, kids say the coolest things sometimes.
They do.
So, and that has a kind of revelation there. At the end of that chapter, she says that something like, the finality of death is only for the living.
Mm-hmm.
That's what helps her deal with her father's death.
Mm. She was very close to her father because her father had defended her, had been her, you know, her mother was kind of overbearing, I think, wasn't she, and wanting her to marry well and so forth, and her father kind of stood up for her.
Right. So he was her really only friend that, you know, she could trust in her father.
Mm-hmm.
And the little we know of her biography, for some reason she was estranged from her mother. We don't really know why, so I had to do things like that on that. And then her father died early. So from that I made up the situations in the story.
Mm-hmm. Now, she was close to her sister, and even when her sister, and then saw that her sister and her family got safely to England.
Yes. That's one of the first things that kind of sucks her into the resistance work, you know. Joseph Campbell talks about heroes and how some heroes go out and on, you know, consciously on purpose wanting to go do some heroic act, but most heroes are just kind of pulled into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And she wants to help her brother-in-law escape from prison, and then she needs to help her brother-in-law's family escape from France, and that just kind of gets her pulled her into it. In Celtic myths and in the Ramayana epic, the hero was led into the adventure by following a golden deer into a forest, and then the golden deer turns into something else.
Mm.
Oh, my.
So Annette is just kind of following, doing things to help her family and others, and gets involved in all this.
Now, is that all historically accurate, or is some of this things that you imagined about her?
Well, I had to make up stories based on the research that I did on the revolution, on the Reign of Terror, and on the counter-revolution. All we know about her, what inspired me to do all this, is a petition to the king in 1816. This is after the fall of Napoleon, when the king was reinstated. This petition was made on behalf of Annette Vallon, and it was to get her a pension after all the work she'd been doing for 25 years or so. And because of what people say about her in this petition, then I figured out, well, there's a lot of things that she did that were courageous that then I can make up stories. But they don't say what she does.
Okay, so that's the only historical document that you actually have about her work in the resistance, is this petition?
Yes. Well, there's also records of Napoleon's secret police that were watching her. This is one that it's funny, you know, her name is Annette Vallon, but she felt she was married to Wordsworth, and so she calls herself Madame Williams, not Madame,
yeah, right.
You know, or Mademoiselle Vallon. And so we have a record of Napoleon's secret police saying Madame Williams is known as an active intriguer. And an intriguer is someone who's involved in the resistance, you know.
Mm.
And he said this in March 1804, and she had been an active intriguer over 10 years by that time. But no one had known it, you know. So it was reading these excerpts, these people that were praising the work she did in 1816.
And how did you find those documents?
Well, there's a handy French critic in 1922 who wrote a little book that's hard to find, called William Wordsworth and Annette Vallon.
Mm.
And he has a lot of this in there. And so that helped out. And he has the actual French documents. He was writing, it was 1922, and then there's another critic, professor, 1921. And really, that was the work that was done on Annette Vallon. No one's really done anything since. As I said, the words of biographers kind of, understate her very much. But he was trying to figure out, well, who is this person? Because the letters were just discovered in 1921.
And where were they found?
In a have you ever cleaned out a drawer and found interesting things?
Yeah.
There's in a sub-police station in the Loire Valley, after World War One, they were cleaning out things. Old files, you know, French love to keep all their red tape files. And they found these letters that were addressed to England, and then they were addressed to William Wordsworth. And somebody was intelligent enough to go, well, isn't this famous poet guy? So they called the professor down from Paris, and he says, yeah, you know. And so then the whole story comes out, and that Wordsworth, who had become a kind of Victorian icon, all of a sudden has an illegitimate daughter and had an affair with a French woman, a Catholic woman. And it's a huge old thing that came out in the early 20s, and that's why this book was done at that time.
Oh, interesting. And then it just got forgotten.
Yeah, well, no one knew anything about it, because Wordsworth's first biographer, who was his grandson, I believe, carefully destroyed any references to his relationship with Annette.
Oh.
And then it was just kind of understated, like it's just a little footnote here and there.
Wow.
Ever since then.
But he has ancestors through his illegitimate daughter. He has ancestors.
Yes, he does. Yes. So he does have some French ancestors. Oh. And his illegitimate daughter got married, and that's a whole other interesting story, because it turns out the Frenchman that she married was the brother of someone whom Wordsworth helped release from prison in the north of England.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
It's very ironic and odd, and the biographers say, okay, well, Wordsworth somehow knew this cavalry officer who was in prison in the north of England. And, you know, well, how did he know him? You know, what's that about?
Oh!
And so in my story, I have Annette and he are still in contact. And she, if there's people from her region, she asks him, because of his influence at that time, could he, you know, help these people? So as soon as there's a peace, these people could get out immediately from prison and come back. And so it's so odd. This cavalry officer comes to Annette's door to bear a message from Wordsworth to her. And that's when she meets his brother, whom Caroline, the daughter, immediately falls in love with.
Oh.
But it's very odd, isn't it? Well, there's this connection to Wordsworth with the guy that Caroline eventually marries.
We are listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is James Tipton, author of Annette Vallon, A Novel of the French Revolution. Did you know a lot about the French Revolution before you started writing this, or did you have to do a lot
not
of
really.
Research?
Emma, you know, I knew Dickens, Tale of Two Cities, mm-hmm. and I knew that other great movie from the 30s, The Scarlet Pimpernel.
Oh, I love that movie.
I'd hardly recommend anybody to read. You know, in my mind, I think part of me was seeing this novel as a cross between Gone with the Wind and Scarlet Pimpernel, or Gone with
right,
the Wind
right.
and Tale of Two Cities, you know. So, no, I didn't know very much. I just started reading, and I love history anyway, because people think they don't like history because it's a bunch of boring dates, but what history really is, of course, is the lives of individual people.
Right.
And by reading these things, I think, well, what are these people's lives like? And that pulled me into it.
Well, how long did you spend researching?
Well, when I was writing the first draft of 3.5 years, I was researching while I was writing it. The main thing was we try to get down the dates and the times right. You know, I couldn't have something happen in November of 1792 that didn't happen, that happened a year later. I didn't want to mess up like that. So I kept to those historical parameters while I was writing the draft. And then years later, when I was rewriting the whole book, I did a lot more research, because my editor, Harper Collins, said, I want more of this Reign of Terror stuff. I want more of her resistance work. So then I did all sorts of research on the Reign of Terror. I had a, you know, huge pile of books, and went through that. But I was used to going through things quickly and trying to get the pith of the matter from working on my PhD and doing academic work. I could blast through these things and then think, okay, how am I going to use them? I could read all this stuff in the world.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't matter unless
right.
I could turn them into stories. So then I had to think what stories that I could make up based on all this. So that research was probably a couple months, actually a couple intense months, and then off and on after that, too. And then when I was rewriting it, I drew from all of that.
Now, as you were researching, did you find any other characters that you thought, oh, maybe that'll be my next book?
That's a good question. I found a new character that I put in this book who was not in the earlier draft. And that's a character who helps Annette in her resistance work called the Marquis.
Mm-hmm.
And he became a very important character. And he's actually based on a real Marquis who, like the Marquis de Lafayette, whom everybody knows about, came to help with the American Revolution. You know, the French were helping the Americans. And he was fighting with the Indians against the British and learned the strategies of kind of guerrilla fighting from the Indians. So when he came back and was helping in the resistance against the what they called the armies of Paris, invading the provinces in the Loire Valley, he used these strategies that he learned from the Indians very skillfully and successfully. So I based the whole character on that Marquis.
Well, was he the aristocrat who, when the mob came, he just opened his home and said, "Take whatever you want," and they took everything but the heavy beds they couldn't carry.
That's the count who is a friend of Annette's family,
mm-hmm.
and I made him up totally. But the invasion of the chateau by the mob and them looting the chateau. Of course, this happened all over France at that time, and especially in the Loire Valley, where all these beautiful chateaus are. But the mobs behaved a little bit differently. Sometimes, if they didn't like the person, they would just kill the person of the chateau and burn the chateau. And if they didn't mind the person, or even like kind of liked them, they wouldn't harm the person. They just loot, get whatever mm-hmm. they could get. But what was interesting about this account is how he is kind of friendly to them while they're looting his chateau.
Right.
And
here, have some wine.
And I didn't make that up totally when I was doing this research. And there's some fat book of 600 pages, and like there's a little half a sentence that says that there's this one aristocrat that when the mob invaded his chateau, he served them omelets.
Yes, he made omelets, right.
I go, what is that? That is so bizarre. And it's easy. I could just read right by it in this historical book. I went, no, I got to use that.
Yeah.
So that's where I got that idea.
Then he said, well, those things they took, they're just things. And, we have our lives, and that's what's important, and that's
yes.
true.
And I think he also understood the inequality that was behind all this. He said,
mm-hmm.
these people are my enemy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, James, do you have an excerpt you'd like to read to us from Annette Vallon, a novel of the French Revolution?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
There's so many many good places there you can
thing.
Choose from.
This is from the preface. So this is after everything has happened in the story. Then she writes this little preface. January 4th, 1821, Paris. It's raining. Through the veiled January day, I can still see the river as if unmoving in the distance. But it is moving. My God, we saw the world change. I want to get it down before I'm old. The window, slightly ajar, brings in the rain-fresh air that mixes with the smell of aged leather on the three diaries in front of me. But it is not all in the diaries, and I had to stop writing them for fear they would fall into the wrong hands. My memories remain fresh and cool. Remember the feel of a silk sleeve on my skin, the lightness of taffeta when I danced, and the big riding cloak when I could feel the reassuring weight of a pistol in each pocket. Remember the river flowing through it all, glazed with sunsets or cracking with ice. We were all young then. So many minds thought France was bringing about a new world of freedom and equality and brotherhood. I loved a young poet who had come from England full of those thoughts, and of a love of words with which to build his own vision. Some tried to change the world. I just tried to live in it, which became increasingly difficult. I loved a young poet then. And if I have another few minutes, I'll
yes.
Oh, yeah.
read a short scene called Nymphs and Satyrs. Is that okay? Have another few more
minutes?
Yes,
please. Oh, yes, absolutely.
This is early on in the Sims book. Actually, it starts on page 5. I liked watching the slanting evening light that gleamed on the wild strawberries in the woods on either side of the road. We had endured a long carriage ride, and it felt good now to be walking toward the Chateau de Chenonceau, its iron gates and front arches and tower just visible at the end of a long aisle of plane trees. I liked this chateau. As a girl one summer, we had stayed here a week, and my older sister Marguerite and I once ran through the long hall that crosses the river, our steps echoing on the black and white checkered floor, river light catching in the panes of the dormer windows, its shadows dancing over the walls. And I stopped and leaned out an open window over the dazzling water and felt that I was not in a stone chateau at all, but in a gabar, a large vessel on the Loire, its sails full. I also got delightfully lost in the maze one evening. As I turned the corners between the hedges, it was like going from one green glade into another. Marguerite finally had to come and fetch me. Now, I was going to my first end-of-the-season fête at this grand chateau. Mama had pointed out what a privilege it was for a girl just out of convent school. And Marguerite, who wasn't coming this year, said you never knew what to expect at the last fête. Papa, who had work to do in town, said these fêtes were silly things, and it would be far more enlightening for me to become more familiar with his library at home. But I couldn't pass up this opportunity. This was life, coming to greet me. And like Julie in my favorite novel, I would open my arms to it. The day had started simply with finding the right satin ribbon that matched the decoration in my wide-brimmed hat. Then we had the long journey following the river west. And tonight, I would observe the elegant dancers, the folded fans swaying from the ladies' wrists as they took the hand of the gentleman who bowed. And they both moved in unison to a music of mathematical precision. The heavenly spheres themselves, hanging in space, were governed by the same harmony that regulated the dancers, I believed. I myself hoped to learn all the intricate steps this summer. Now it was enough just to watch. Mama held the arm of our old family friend, Count Thibault, of the Chateau de Beauregard. "Come now, ladies, we're late," he said. "Why wouldn't dear Madame Dupin allow us this year to drive our carriages to the door? This is not in good taste or style," Mama said. I was teetering on my heels, trying not to look gauche. "Man was born to suffer," the Count said. "Oh, you can't say that," said Maman, "with your buckled shoes and walking cane. I think it's most inconsiderate of Madame, as if we're peasants. Who's ever heard of walking to a ball?" "It is just the entryway, my dear. We will all deserve our refreshments, and you know what an old eccentric Madame Dupin is." Just then I thought I saw something coming towards us in the woods to my right. Looked on the other side of the drive and saw it there, too, a flicker of a shape, darting swiftly between the trees, then hiding behind them. We were almost to the entrance of the chateau. In a sudden flurry of movement, figures leaped from behind the trees and surrounded us. The light was dim now, and I could only make out that they didn't look quite human. They had horns on their heads, were bare-chested, and as they pranced around us, appeared to have hooves. The Count drew his sword. The creatures were wailing in a demented way and leering at us, especially at me. One tugged at the long sash of my dress. I slapped his hairy hand. Another leaped by and whisked his fingers through my hair. "Get away, get away," Mama cried, waving the back of her hand at them. The Count set himself in the en garde position, his cane balanced in one hand and the sword in the other, ready to lunge against the beasts from another world. Then he laughed and sheathed his sword. "They're in costume, the fools we are. This is Madame Dupin's way to usher us to the party." As if in assent, one of the satyr-like creatures motioned us to follow him toward the chateau. Mama and the Count started, and I held back. "Annette, don't be afraid," Mama said. "These are Madame Dupin's satyrs. They won't hurt you." Then one pranced by my side, nodded his head, bent down, and lifted my silk dress and underskirts well above my knees, and ran off. But Mama had turned her back. Didn't notice. "Always does something strange for the last fête," she said to the Count. It has leaped ahead of us now in the dusk. At the moat, they melted into a crowd of waiting guests, bobbing among them, pinching and dancing. Torches hung in sconces set in the chateau wall. Everyone was staring down into the moat. I heard lovely pastoral music. I'm small and couldn't see over women's ostrich plumes, palm-like feathers, or hats with lace brims. Not walking on my feet but balancing on the heels, I must have said, pardon me, 100 times. Weaving my way through a sea of satin-covered hip pads or long trains falling on the ground. Then I saw it too. A small barge with an orchestra on it, coming gently toward us on the current of the River Cher, diverted here into the moat. Silver candlesticks sat on veneer wood tables beside the musicians. As if we were one person, the crowd sighed in appreciation. A gentleman shouted, bravo! And we all applauded. Then we gasped. From a door in the wall just above the level of the moat, 6 young women dove, one after another, into the water and swam around the raft. Their gossamer-thin muslin gowns, once wet, made them appear naked. Their slender arms, dipping in and out of the water, shone in the torchlight. Then they floated directly below us, their faces upturned, and every one of them was beautiful. They began to sing, something I vaguely recognized from an opera Papa had taken me too long ago. The denizens of our sacred groves have prepared for you a glorious festival, and already their sweet pipes announce the happy moment when you shall reign over them. At the end of the last phrase, 6 satyrs jumped into the water and proceeded to caress or kiss the lovely maidens. The nymphs and the satyrs, a gentleman cried. Bravo, Madame Dupin, you have outdone yourself. We all applauded again. The crowd swept across the drawbridge to the terrace as the barge and the nymphs floated around the bend in the moat. I was glad for the swimmers that it was such a warm night. 4 years later, when the revolution began, I was often glad that, because the villagers loved old Madame Dupin, the Chateau de Chenonceau was not sacked or burned.
Hmm. Well, you had a lot of course, description there, but you had some wonderful descriptions of when Annette was riding. Her father taught her to ride and hunt, and she had a horse that she loved dearly. And the riding out in the snowfall was my favorite description.
Well, that's interesting because I just wanted to read a paragraph where she is riding her horse. She's so close to her horse. Her horse is named La Rouge, and it becomes a very good friend and ally of hers in all her work that she does. I'll just read this little paragraph where she's by herself here. And it's also near the beginning of the book. I rode and rode until the heavy cares of past, present, and future had dropped off far behind. I sat still and allowed La Rouge, her horse, to paw through the snow for a mouthful of grass. And as dark descended and hardly a breeze whispered and a new set of flakes fell, I felt a peace that rose up out of the winter earth and enveloped me. I felt a presence of something vast and intimate, in which I was a small yet conscious part. I felt it before, when I paused by the river or at the edge of the woods. I called it the presence of the Virgin, for I was taught to give it that name, but one could, I suppose, just as easily give it the pagan name of some spirit of the water or of the trees.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of too. And William, at one point, I think this was after when he came back, and he had to leave, and he said, "Reason alone misses many things," because he was always trying to look at the positive side of everything, wasn't he?
Yes. Also, kind of from his idealistic point of view.
Mm-hmm.
But she is a person of the heart, and I see her as a hero who is a heart creature who is driven a lot by compassion, and he's a very mind person. And so we have this revelation there that, well, reason misses a lot of things. Mm. And there's a line from a French philosopher that she likes, that that the heart knows reason that the heart knows the reasons that reason knows nothing of.
Well, you're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and we've been listening to James Tipton read from his a recently published book, Annette Vallon, A Novel of the French Revolution, published by HarperCollins and available here in town at Revelations Bookstore, who kindly loaned us a copy of the book.
Yes.
So that we would be prepared for this interview. And James, I understand you've had some, when we were talking before we went on the air, that you've had some really wonderful publicity for the book quite recently.
Well, just yesterday, USA Today, that sounds funny, USA Today yesterday had a review that was very nice on the book. They called it marvelous, which is a wonderful adjective to have attached to it.
I think, yes.
Wow. And when was it actually published?
The book?
Mm-hmm.
Mid-November.
And have you been doing a book tour? Have you done readings around, you know, how are you publicizing?
It's around the Bay Area.
Okay.
The other good publicity was that Barnes & Noble made it a discovery pick for the holiday season.
Oh.
So it was on a special shelf all through the holiday season for Barnes & Noble. But I've just done some readings around here, and I'll do another one in the Bay Area next week. But no, I'm not doing a tour. It would be kind of fun to do that. I would like to go back to Iowa and Fairfield, do a reading there, but I don't have any immediate plans.
Well, you know, even people who think they don't like history or are not interested would find this an interesting book because of the characterization, the marvelous, I'll say marvelous characterization that you do of all the characters and the people that come and go. And, you know, there was one place where these soldiers dragged a priest out of a barn and beat him and so forth. And one of them said, "Revenge will prosper sooner than love." And
that's a bad guy perspective.
Yeah, right. And I thought, well, that's probably how some of them really felt. Some of these soldiers and these people really felt.
Yes, but they're not right.
No, they're not.
Now, James, is this your first published book?
First novel. I published a book of poems actually when I was in Iowa, called Sacred Places. The last book of that was just bought off of Amazon by someone in the College of Marin where I teach now. So that's out of print.
Okay.
I published a fair amount of poems and stories, but this is definitely my first novel, yes.
And how did you find a publisher? I mean, HarperCollins is a premier publisher. How were you able to do that?
Well, I guess I had some luck. I had an agent who was sending it out, but this agent and I disagreed. She changed the name, and she cut off the first several chapters, and she had sent it around, and it was with an editor at HarperCollins who passed on it, but who sent a very long letter back to the agent and said, you send this letter to the author, and it was about how much she liked it, how much that she didn't like a few things, and one of them she didn't like was the title, and da-da-da-da. Well, this agent tried some other places. It didn't work. So I broke up with the agent, and then I approached the editor on my own. But fortunately, this is where the tricky luck part comes in. Because I had this letter from her, from the agent, I had her email address, her personal email address on this letter. So I just emailed her personally and said, "Hey, do you remember this novel from, you know, about 9 months ago? What happened was that my original title got taken away and a lot of chapters this agent took off, and I would like to show you what it originally was." And she emailed me back immediately and said, "I remember that novel very well. Send that novel to me the way you originally had it." So I did that, and then she said that she liked it and wanted to, buy it. So that's how I got in with HarperCollins. But it was on my own.
That's a great story.
That's interesting that you were able to do it. It's interesting that she could remember that long ago. It must have really impressed her, because 9 months is a long time to, and all the things she has to read and pass on and everything.
Yeah, they have to read a lot.
Yeah.
So, yes, I was very happy that she remembered it.
Uh-huh.
That's why my first sentence was, "I don't know if you remember this."
So, James, are you working on another novel now? Or have you worked on another one since
I have two projects I'm working on. One is a collection of short stories. Short stories are wonderful, I tell you, to write, because I can write them in one afternoon and then revise it the next day. And I'm not years older when I finish it.
Right.
And then I have another novel that I finished the first draft of just before I got involved with HarperCollins and all on the rewrites for Annette Malone. So I haven't looked back at it for over 3 years.
Wow.
So it's sitting in my closet, and the first draft is complete. I know what a huge project it is, so I'm a little bit hesitant to open those folders.
And
again,
can you tell us what it's about?
It's another historical story, but it's very different. It takes a Miwok Indian from this region here in Marin County. The Russians were here in the early 1800s. The Russians actually were just north in Sonoma County. And it takes this Miwok Indian boy when all of a sudden he's, and the novel starts, he's actually in his 40s, and he's in St. Petersburg, Russia, serving as a valet, butler kind of guy, and he doesn't remember where he's from because he was stolen, kidnapped the Russians at such a young age, you know, four or so. He just kind of blocked it all out, and he has this amnesia, and he goes through lots of things in Russia, eventually has to leave Russia because he gets in trouble and goes to France just in time for the 1848 revolution, so I have another French revolution in there. And then he eventually ends back up with the gold rush in San Francisco.
Wow.
And then he is he's a stranger in his native land when he finally comes back.
So a true epic.
Yeah, it's another
novel.
Epic that goes over continents and historical periods.
Well, the gold rush is a historical story in itself.
Unfortunately, we don't have time to get into this. We are completely out of time.
Oh, gosh, it's been great.
Thank you so much for joining us today, James.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Really enjoyed your book.
We'll look forward to speaking with you again when you're ready to publish your next project.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And, Mom, do you have a quote for us?
Yes,
I
do. It says, life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forward.
And thank you for joining us on Writers' Voices, and we will see you next week.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.